As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Here we are, folks, another episode of the Positively Trek podcast with your hosts. That's me, Dan Gunther, and with me, of course, is the awesome Barry DeFord. Barry, how are you doing today?
I'm wonderful. It's a nice morning discussion we're having. Usually we have these discussions in the evening, but I've had my coffee, the sun's shining, and I always find my voice is a little better for radio in the morning, right? It gets that nice deep baritone to it.
Yeah, there's kind of a little bit of an association with audio stuff and morning, right? Because everybody is heading to work. Everybody knows the various morning shows that could be like the deep thinky stuff with the gravelly voice like this, or it could be the wild morning crew with
Barry and Dan coming to you from the Argus Array. Watch
and
out,
special guest Ricky the Goof. I don't know.
Oh man, we missed our calling. We're doing exactly what we want. We're on a radio-ish
totally.
Sort of thing. Yeah, never mind.
Yeah,
we just muscled our way into this. Perfect.
Does the Star Trek universe have its equivalent of like those wacky morning shows? Like we saw Neelix with his show on Voyager, his little video show. But like, are there podcasts or whatever the equivalent is that people tune into on the regular on Star Trek? I would love to see that.
I would imagine in a post-scarcity society where basically you can just follow your dreams, there are definitely people who will wend their time away talking about just the goofiest stuff, I would imagine, and get complete fulfillment out of it for the 7 to 10 listeners who are also into the same thing. So yeah, no, I 100% think that the Star Trek universe would have goofs just like us chitter-chattering away about whatever. I think that would be wonderful.
I want to see now on the Enterprise where Picard walks in, gets his morning Earl Grey, goes to the computer, hits the button and says, "Welcome everybody to the newest episode of the Dixon Hill cast. I'm your host, Tracy Torme, and with me..."
I was going to be like, "And now for our new segment, can you say that in Klingon?"
Oh man, okay. I think we have an idea for a new episode to do at some point.
Yeah. Is that Klingon or someone choking to death?
Only mildly offensive. You know.
Yeah, exactly.
The Klingon Empire has lodged a complaint. And by lodged a complaint, they meant a batleth into the person. No, I'm just kidding.
All right, I'm doing one more. We've received our 55th request from a Lieutenant Worf who wants to hear Melota. All right, let's get Melota started.
Yes.
Melota.
Oh, man. Okay. Well, we're getting complaints from a fat Ferengi that he's not enjoying it.
Yeah,
so we'll move on.
Exactly.
All right. Well, today's episode, we're not talking about that, but I could talk more about that for hours. That would be fun. Mm-hmm. But we're talking about today is the idea of these storylines or basically hanging story ideas from across the Star Trek universe that have not been followed up on in canon Star Trek. And that little qualifier will become important, I think, as we go on. And this was something that, you know, we were trying to think of what we were going to talk about for this episode. And there's so many things that, like, either are just very blatant setups for a story that never came, or even just kind of tantalizing things that, boy, it would be really cool to revisit this again sometime and see what happened here. So Barry and I have both kind of come up with our own separate lists, not really consulting with each other and seeing what we came up with. And looking at the lists now, I'm very pleased with how there's a couple of crossovers, but for the most part, what we have chosen, we have two very different lists, which is very exciting. It's going to be a great discussion, I think.
I agree. I think, you know, we're talking about decades of different writers coming in, sometimes, you know, just trying to get something finished. You know, the classic Star Trek TNG thing is always this high concept episode that after the third act kind of has to tumble to the end because they realize they've only got 5 minutes of episode left. And so sometimes you get these larger plot holes from the 60s to the 80s to now where it's not perfect, right? These are just writers writing a show, and there are going to be moments in time when they're not going to correlate with things. Now, I will say that the writers these days are, I would say they're almost mining from some of this stuff. And I think we're going to find that the novelists pioneered that in a lot of ways. And so there might be some things that I might mention that actually have been covered in the novelizations, but I'm kind of going more by just the episodes themselves for your workaday Star Trek fan who doesn't necessarily read all of the books.
Absolutely. But the cool thing about this too is if there is something on this list that you're like, yeah, why did they never follow up on that? I will be pointing out, at least as far as my knowledge goes, which is not all of the novels and comics, but a few of them, a lot of these have been kind of followed up on outside of the canon stuff. So if you are looking for some answers, not canon ones, but some possible answers to some of these mysteries or some revisitations to these situations and people, maybe I can point you in the right direction and you can find some interesting stories out there that deal with these. That's definitely the case for a few of these. So
exactly. And I mean, the Positively Trek book club might even touch on some of these in certain pieces of time. So stay tuned, kids.
I guarantee for one of them, we absolutely will be fairly soon. So
hint, hint.
Awesome. Well, looking at these lists, Barry, why don't you lead us off with a pick from your list? And I kind of had mine in order of series, but I don't think that matters. I think just wherever the conversation takes us, whatever you feel like is the one you want to start out with.
Yeah, mine is 100% a scattershot of shower thoughts, I like to think of. And I'm going to start with the very first one that does actually, like, sometimes just cross my mind. And that is Famke Janssen's character in The Perfect Mate, where to catch up anyone who might not have seen it recently or not seen this episode at all, it's from Star Trek The Next Generation, where Captain Picard comes across a very special piece of cargo that turns out to actually be a person. Human trafficking implications notwithstanding, she is a person who kind of gets conditioned to love the person she's with by spending time with them. It's sort of like she gets promised to a person and then she falls in love. It doesn't happen with the person she's supposed to. Instead, she winds up falling in love with Captain Picard, but in a act of honor, they both decide to move on with their lives. She goes with the person she was quote-unquote promised to. Picard goes on captaining the Enterprise, but it is very deeply understood that her character fell in love with Picard and will now be in love with him for the rest of her life, therefore living a lie for the rest of her days. And this is never really followed up on, as far as I know. She just goes off and will live a lonely and miserable life, for lack of a better term. And it's something that definitely does pull at one's heartstrings and also kind of gives us a sense of a lack of justice. And I mean, there are a little bit of misogynistic overtones there, but overall, I've always wanted to know what might have happened to this character, how she would have dealt with things. It would have been great to see her come back in the Star Trek Picard series as well as a potential love interest even. I mean, or maybe she's overcome it somehow and then she can come back and say, Jean-Luc, you know, I loved you for a really, really long time, but I was able to actually overcome my own, you know, neural programming, and now I'm a free person. I don't have to love anyone if I don't want to. I can just freely go about my life without that burden anymore. And so back in the day when I first saw that episode, I'd have been a young, you know, preteen, I would suspect. And I found myself quite attracted to Famke Janssen's character and, you know, the type of person she kind of made herself out to be. And I remember thinking quite a lot about that of, you know, are we ever going to see her again? Is she ever going to come back? What's she doing? How is she doing? The guy who she wound up with, is he treating her well? All of these questions always kind of came to mind. And it is sort of disappointing that it never got any further discussion. I mean, I can understand it's something problematic to a lot of degrees here, but that's my first opening conversation is a character whose potential, you know, was really just for an episode, kind of Kirk-like. You know, from our last episode, Captain Kirk left a wake of ladies as well to some degree. But Jean-Luc is always a more honorable person. And now he is also not someone without kind of these hanging losses. I like to think of the inner light, right? There's an entire life that he led that he just doesn't really talk about very often. But yeah, no, that would be my first one. What were your thoughts on that episode when you saw it? Or what are your thoughts on that episode overall?
Yeah, like you, I saw that very early in my life. I think actually, interestingly enough, season 5 of TNG is when I first started watching Star Trek The Next Generation live on television. So I did see that when it first came out. I was also a very young man. And yeah, like this episode, I'm pretty sure, I haven't looked it up, but I'm assuming written for men by men.
Yeah, very much so.
Very much so. So yeah, like you, it played on all of those thoughts in my head at that age. And I absolutely fell for this character as well. And yeah, in retrospect, having grown up, it's very telling that character bears all of the fallout of the episode and we never see her again. Like Picard has some regrets and feels sad about it, but he doesn't have this biological condition that's going to like potentially eat away at his psyche for the rest of his life because of this incident. And she, by implication of the episode, is. And we never have to see her again. We never have to worry about her again. But yeah, I always was curious if we'd see her again, if something would change in that situation. I think that's a very compelling one. And one that inspires a lot of thoughts of, you know, Picard's continued career afterwards and the life he leads. Is there someone out there who's following that career and maybe paying attention to where he is and what he's doing? Or not cutting herself off completely so that this doesn't affect her. Like, I don't know. I'd be really curious. Now, there is, as far as I know, no direct follow-up to her character outside of the shows or anything like in novels or comics. If anyone out there knows any differently, though, please let us know.
We just want to know she's okay.
Exactly. There is some interesting follow-up with her species, though, the Creotians, and another empathic metamorph is one of the characters in the Star Trek Voyager relaunch novels that take place after the series. So written by Kirsten Beyer, this series of novels chronicles Voyager leading a fleet back to the Delta Quadrant for exploration purposes via slipstream technology. And one of the characters is an empathic metamorph, and there's some interesting stuff done with her story there that in some ways, because it's Kirsten Beyer, I think writes some of the issues. I mean, doesn't change this episode and what it says, but kind of recontextualizes a few things about the Creotians that maybe kind of and calls out some of the problematic things about that story as well. So some interesting stuff there that if people are interested in the Creotians and empathic metamorphs, you might want to check that out.
Yeah. And I guess to kind of put a pin in that one, just to start the conversation, my hope would be that, yes, she somehow managed through meditation or something to overcome that programming altogether and be able to be more free-willed in her ability to love whomever she pleases. So That's kind of my headcanon that you know, it will take a little bit. It'll probably be filled with a certain amount of anguish and frustration, But in the end, my hope is that she would be able to overcome that and overcome any male figure in her life moving forward. So there's my first one. What about yourself? What's the one that really picks at your brain?
Well, I'm going to jump back. I'm going to go right to almost the very beginning of Star Trek, the second pilot from Star Trek, the original series, where no man has gone before. And that's the idea of these human espers, where it is scientifically cataloged, apparently, that many humans have the ability, or some humans have the ability, to foretell future events and read the backs of playing cards and these sorts of things that maybe in the 1960s felt like they were kind of on the cusp of scientific rigor and investigation, but maybe today, and I hope I'm not stepping on toes out there, seem like flim flam.
Yeah.
And nonsense. But it's interesting that, yeah, by the mid-23rd century, apparently humans are documented to have some of these abilities. We just never hear of it again. So I'd be curious on a follow-up of that. Like, are they just a regular part of society? Have they become a new group within society? Babylon 5, I think, does the idea of human telepaths very interestingly, and it would be interesting to see if it kind of traveled along that route, or is this something that maybe further scientific rigor kind of dismissed at a later date, and that's why we don't hear about them?
My biggest question about that episode is a little more practical, in the sense that I wonder how badly the actor's corneas got ripped up by that tinfoil they had to put in their eyes.
And reportedly not good.
Oh, I can only imagine the things you do for a paycheck. My goodness. Now, I will say that I am aware that the somewhat disgraced fan-made series that has kind of utilized that conversation to kind of close the circuit to some degree, but you're right. It really doesn't come up in canon whatsoever anymore, which again, I wonder sometimes if the writers who are going to be writing further stuff into the future might possibly be able to kind of select from that and build something from there. Because, I mean, clairvoyance and everything like that, I for me, the jury is out. I do think that there are certain times where someone's intuition can verge on premonition, I guess you could say. But I'm not one to say that necessarily any human being is going to be able to completely see the future per se, but I'd love to have that knowledge. And I mean, what one does with that knowledge, I think that's where we kind of get into things, that you could use these powers for both evil and for good equally. And it really depends on the character you have. But yeah, I don't know. It would be neat to even have someone on the bridge with something like that. You know, we've had Deanna Troi and her empathic abilities to understand what people's emotions are, but even to see sometimes like Prince of Persia style, just a little bit into the future, or even being able to kind of rewind backward. And I love the idea of telekinesis, right? Again, going back to Famke Janssen when she played Jean Grey, she had some pretty good powers, and then those powers got way out of control, and then the entire storyline of the original X-Men movie series went kaput because they just... What can you do with that? And maybe to some degree, the espers in Where No Man Has Gone Before ultimately were just too overpowered to even work with. And I think in a lot of cases, this is what we're going to see with a lot of our loose ends, especially when it comes to these beings that come and go, is they're just too overpowered. Like, if you had them as a regular person or a regular character, it would kind of take the stakes down a little bit if they had such incredible abilities. So I can kind of see why we wouldn't necessarily want to go into this, but typically in typical Star Trek fashion, yeah, the big powerful thing gets defeated sort of ignominiously, and then we move on.
Yeah. I also just love the fact that Gary Mitchell and Elizabeth Daner's Starfleet records have this on them. Like, at some point during their academy career or induction into Starfleet or whatever, somebody sat across from them and did the playing card test. And like, I guess every Starfleet officer has to do that. I picture, you know, Peter Venkman from Ghostbusters doing that, right?
And Gary spits his gum out when he gets zapped.
Exactly. This was kind of on my mind a little bit because in the last couple days I did go see the movie Madame Web.
Oh, okay.
It is not good. Don't go see it. It is so bad. But you know, that's kind of her ability, is the ability. And I was like, wait, they said that people could do this in Star Trek. I forgot about that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I don't know. Now, there is a bit of a follow-up to this in a Christopher Bennett novel that came out in 2020 called The Higher Frontier, where he kind of tied the idea of human espers to what Gene Roddenberry called the New Human Movement, which was right. from the motion picture novelization, which is a bit of weirdness. So he kind of tied those together and gave them an interesting story, and also kind of explained why we don't see them later on. Mm. So Christopher L. Bennett is a master at doing those ties to past continuity and stuff. So nothing canon, but
yeah.
That episode is a trip if you want to read that.
Yeah. Roddenberry did get a little wooey sometimes, I find, in that regard.
Yes.
I think he could kind of paint himself into a bit of a corner whenever he explored it. So I am glad that to some degree that could have taken Star Trek in a very different direction if we were dealing with a little more wooey powers like clairvoyance and telekinesis and whatnot. I mean, again, you know, characters like Guinan, I think, do a little more justice to that, where she's extremely guarded with her somewhat seemingly supernatural powers and stuff like that. So,
and also they technobabble tie it to things like, you know, quantum fluctuations in the space-time continuum and subspace fields or whatever. So
sure.
Yeah. Okay. So what do you have next on your list?
This one I think about actually on the daily, and it has everything to do with the ships themselves and space and what I understand of space and everything else. I love the Star Trek ship designs. They are forever in my heart. Matt Jeffries was a freaking genius when he came to that three-part ratio. Looking at the original Enterprise, there is no bad angle. It looks good from every single angle. And I played that one Star Trek app game. I forget what it's called, but you know, your ships were basically stationary and you had little cards you could play with them and all that sort of stuff. And I remember I had the original Star Trek Enterprise as one of my ones, and it's always, you know, framed behind like a lovely nebula or a planet or something like that, or a series of asteroids. And I just remember sometimes I would just go on the app and spin the camera around and just look at the ship because it is so attractive. So that little bit of throat clearing aside, first of all, I think that obviously The Expanse has a much better representation of how space travel would actually look. Ships that are built like buildings, and the speed that you're going creates the artificial gravity, right? The momentum that you're traveling at creates that artificial gravity. And then when you're slowing down, you flip, and then you slowing down will then also create that artificial gravity. And when I think about the way ships fight each other in Star Trek, it's always kind of like Rock'em Sock'em Robots, where they just come nose to nose and just start blasting each other, which again, there's no subtlety there. And I often think, you know, they would be hiding behind planets, and they would be almost, you know, practically like a battle could take place between like Jupiter and Mercury, right? Something like that, where you're dealing with small amounts of time, space, you know, warping and everything else like that. So my big question is, the one thing in Star Trek that I wonder why it isn't used more often is the Picard maneuver. And I'm not talking about the tunic pull that Sir Pat Stewart does. More so, it's what he did to defeat the Ferengi with the Stargazer, where he hit warp just for like a yocto second and wound up in two places at once, and the Ferengi didn't know what to shoot at, and he did it. Why aren't they doing that more often? Why aren't they bouncing around at each other? And I mean, obviously, the special effects artists who may be listening to this might be going, Barry, shut up. Barry, shut up. No. But it would look cool, and I think it actually makes a lot of sense, right? If you get fired at, just zip to your left slightly using the warp field, right? You got these giant nacelles, use them, right? Warp some space-time around yourself. Use that as a shield. That one always kind of gets me in the sense that, you know, the Romulans and the Klingons have cloaking ability, right? The Borg can suddenly adapt to whatever you're firing at them. The Dominion are just crazy AF and will just fly at you, right? The rest in peace Odyssey, just going straight into their deflector dish.
One out for Captain Keogh and his crew.
Oh, yeah. What a guy, you know, just was not expecting that one. That actually just really quick aside, that really bothered me. Watching a Galaxy class starship get smoked in like 3 seconds, that really did kind of take the wind out of my sails, pun intended.
And to continue the tangent, the timing of that was the end of Deep Space Nine season 2, which was also coinciding with the end of TNG season 7. And the whole purpose of that was for the writers of Deep Space Nine saying, if Picard had drawn the card to take this mission and take the Enterprise into the Gamma Quadrant, the Enterprise would have been destroyed.
Oh, man. Yeah, no, that's...
That was their whole point.
That's the implication. Jeez and crow. Well, yeah, and the Dominion, right? Like, very much every single species in Star Trek seems to have these little technological tweaks and foibles that they're able to utilize. And obviously, of course, what that means is human beings have their cunning and their abilities and their their diplomacy, and they don't need all these blah, blah, blahs. But to some degree, I just think, okay, we're going to pick 5 spots in space that we're just going to bounce around, and we've got inertial dampers, right? We know what we're doing. Let's just blind them with like 30 different ships all at once. Let's be in several places at once. They don't know what to shoot at. And then we'll just keep firing at them because they're going to stay in one place because they think it's Rock'em Sock'em Robots. So that would be my kind of larger conversation around the Picard maneuver and just how Captain Picard is known for this amazing maneuver that he never uses again and no one ever uses at all.
Yeah, especially given that, you know, it's required reading at the Academy and stuff, and it's kind of in the big book of Starfleet, the big book of Starfleet tactics or whatever. Now, I will say it inspired a maneuver in the final episode of season 1 of Picard, where it's cited as like, it confuses the enemy. It gives 2 chips in the same place at the same time. They don't use warp drive for it. Instead they use, and if I'm remembering correctly, the magical device that gives them whatever they want. I don't really understand how that works, but that's how they created the illusion that there was like 100
La Serena
attacking the Romulans. Yeah. So it served as inspiration in that one instance. But yeah, you'd think another captain would have tried this a few times or something.
Exactly. So, you know, I mean, actual naval battles today, you don't actually even see the ship you're fighting in a lot of cases. It's beyond the horizon, right? As much as that does kind of like doesn't lend well to good television, right? You know, again, you know, imagine some Starfleet captain being like, ships up, and then just something explodes, right? And that would be the end of it. Perhaps that's not as interesting. But that would be my other big kind of loose end of space combat itself. And I mean, there would be implications of, you know, ship designs. I actually think the Borg sphere is the most accurate style of space-based warship that one would ever want to fly in, because there's weapons on all sides. The propulsion comes from within, basically, and there's no up or down.
Yeah, that's a good one. It's one that kind of like the saucer separation, I guess, in TNG. You kind of expected to see more often because they made such a big deal of it.
Too expensive.
Yeah, exactly. Well, for my next one, I'm going to dip back to TOS again, just because I feel like we don't talk enough about the original series sometimes.
True fact.
And this was my earliest introduction to Star Trek, was watching TOS on CBC television here in Canada at 8 in the morning on Saturday mornings. Everyone else was watching cartoons. I flipped over to CBC and watched the original Star Trek. And one of the first episodes I remember watching that really captured my attention was The Squire of Gothos and the character of Trelane, who was just like, William Campbell played this character so well. Just this pompous, over-the-top, foppish individual who countered Kirk at every move and had this haughty sense of like, oh, you can't hurt me. Very, you know, Q-like, of course. We would see a character similar to him later, but a different character in that he had some sort of mechanism that was powering his illusions. And also, of course, by the end of the episode, you find out that he is a child. He's not, you know, this godlike character, but instead is told by his parents to come in and stop playing with the little creatures out there, kind of thing. This is a character I think would have been really interesting to see come up again, maybe in a later series, perhaps grown, perhaps maybe a counter to Q of some kind. I don't know. Now, he has appeared, of course, because he's a very tantalizing character outside of the canon. We've seen him show up in novels and comics. And in fact, a very good novel, Q Squared by Peter David, posits that he is actually a Q, just a juvenile Q, which I was never really satisfied with. I love that novel. I think it's a great story, really cool time stuff and multiple universe stuff going on there. But I was never really satisfied with the, oh, he's just a Q, just a young one. There's enough differences there that I think he's something very different, and I would have loved to have seen him show up maybe on Deep Space Nine and Sisko punching him doesn't get rid of him. So I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, again, we're looking at the I think TOS lends itself well to the, sort of these loose ends, right? Because, of course, Star Trek is in its infancy. It doesn't really have the established foundation that it would have. So kind of squaring the circle later, like it would be a Q or something along those lines, kind of makes sense. And I'm actually just going to roll this in together instead of making it a completely different topic. But my sense feels the same about the Traveler, in the sense he comes in, he's monolithic in his power, right? He can literally take the Enterprise wherever he wants throughout the galaxy. There's really no stopping him. If he was malevolent, more so, you know, he's, you know, a learner and a grower, whereas Trelane is mischievous, I would say, more than anything, much like a Q. If either were sufficiently malevolent, we wouldn't have much of a series, right? They could have just come in and run roughshod over the entire thing. So I like the idea of him, you know, of maybe seeing a grown-up Trelane show up later and be like, hey, guys, sorry, I was just a dumb kid, you know. How's Kirk doing, by the way? Oh, really? Oh, God. Oh, a bridge? He fell off? What? Oh, that's lame. You know, something.
Oh, like the bridge of a starship. Oh, no, no. Oh, an actual bridge. But that's weird.
Oh, my. Isn't that what
maybe
he said?
Maybe. So Kirk, when he dies, gets this like shocked look and says, oh my, and then dies. Maybe he saw Trelane.
Yeah, Trelane's just waving at him being like, hey, buddy, hey. I'm all grown up now. We can get along. It's all good. And yeah, the same kind of goes for the Traveler, right? I feel like this kind of falls into the same sort of thing. I mean, obviously, the Traveler's weird mittens that he has makes him slightly different there. But you know, him coming in and scouting around for people to go on trips with him and stuff like that also indicates, much like Esper's, that anyone can become something like this or perhaps something along those lines. Whereas Trelane, yeah, is his own species in that sense. He was born into the power that he had and wields it like a kid who's got his dad's gun. So, and it also reminds me, I haven't watched The Squire of Gothos in a very long time. So I think I might pick that one up later. That one is a cheeky and fun episode.
It is a good one. I think what attracted me to it so much is that idea that, like, this guy could swat the Enterprise like a fly, and he's playing with them the whole time. Like, at any moment, he could just kind of whisk Kirk out of existence, and there's a genuine sense of danger throughout the whole thing, that this being is completely unhinged. You find out that's immaturity. It's not that he's insane, it's that he's a little kid with a magnifying glass torturing ants. Like, that's what he's doing, right? Yeah, he could, of course, stomp on all the ants and kill them all right away. And there's a very real danger that could happen at any moment. But Kirk has to kind of keep him off balance and keep him playing in order to figure out how to survive for the next 5 minutes, kind of thing. It's terrifying.
It's cunning. It's all cunning, right? We humans and our cunningness, right? Well, the other one, and this one I have to give a little bit of a loving shout out to Red Shirts Always Die. Love you guys. Love your work. And that is Gary Seven, James Bond of the galaxy. He's pretty cool, right? He's dashing. He's got a plan. He knows what he's doing. And then he never comes back, which I found out through Red Shirts Always Die, is that he was what they call a hedge. And what that is a sort of semi-second pilot that Roddenberry wanted to get another series started with, despite Star Trek's success or failure. But it was kind of like a, you know, another channel that this science fiction series could have gone in. And I mean, the implications around that are very big, in the sense that what could have possibly come of the Star Trek universe had we gone more into the that style of intrigue and whatnot. And I wonder if maybe this is where we could see him showing up in Michelle Yeoh's Section 31 series. I've been thinking a lot about the opportunities we could utilize for a Gary Seven character to show up in something like that, or even Gary Seven himself to come back and either play as a trusted companion, a skyhook helper, or a villain. I think that would be really cool, is a Gary Seven-like character who's turned, much like what's-his-face in Goldeneye, Trevelyan.
Mm-hmm.
He's actually bad or something. But I think a lot about, again, the original series and how, you know, they were sort of kind of just throwing pickles at the window to see what sticks. I used to do that at McDonald's back in the day until they kicked me out for doing it. it's fun. Anyway.
probably not for the minimum wage workers that had to deal with you, but
no, yeah. No, you're absolutely right. I feel bad for them, but I feel nothing for the company. It can, whatever.
Here.
Bad words. But yeah, the idea of Gary Seven, though, is really fascinating and fun. Again, I wonder to some degree if Gary Seven was going to come back later in season 5, 6, or 7 of Enterprise. I think he would have fit in quite nicely there as well. But rants later coming. Enterprise has a lot of loose ends in my mind. Mm-hmm. A lot of missed opportunities and just sort of floating potentials that just never came to anything, which is not necessarily disappointing, right? The series is what it is, and the franchise is still in existence. So, I mean, anything that might have been missed could still get picked up moving forward. So, yeah, I really like Gary Seven. I like his idea. He obviously is, again, very much a product of the 1960s, this dashing spy and whatnot, the intrigue and everything else. It comes pretty nicely, but no, he just sort of comes and goes. He disappears, and that's the last we see of him.
Gary Seven, very compelling character. And yeah, like you said, this kind of backdoor pilot idea. I would have loved to have seen Assignment Earth as a series. That would have been very cool. I loved in season 2 of Picard how, and a lot of people didn't, a lot of people don't like that season of Picard, and it has its issues. But I loved in the final episode how they kind of tied together the whole Gary Seven's group with the Travelers, which we also just spoke about, and kind of made Wesley the face of that. So, like, how cool would an Assignment Earth type series be with Wesley as kind of the lead of this group that are doing the intervening or whatever? It strikes me as almost a Doctor Who-ish type take on Star Trek a little bit, especially with the little, what are the servo that he uses that, you know, very much feels like a sonic screwdriver.
You're right, actually. That would be very interesting. I don't know if the way Wesley was written that he could be, say, as dashing as Gary Seven. He's more of a, wasn't his name Q as well, the gadget guy in James Bond?
Oh yes, yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
He's more of a that could, Q.
Yeah, or I could almost see him as like the guy back at headquarters, mm-hmm. right? Not like Q, like you say, but almost maybe a spy master or yeah. something, sending his assets out into the field. Ooh, right?
Yeah, Wesley's assets.
Yeah, he could be like Charlie, I guess, in Charlie's Angels or something. I don't know.
My goodness, Wesley's Angels. I don't know if that I don't know if that rolls off the tongue quite as well.
Probably not. Yeah. But yeah. That would be interesting. As far as Gary Seven himself goes, of course, yeah, we never saw him again in canon Star Trek, but hoo boy, the list of times he has shown up elsewise. I think there's a Greg Cox novel called Assignment Eternity, ooh, which I have not read, but I've heard very good things about. He shows up in the comics quite a bit. I think they had a whole run with him in the old DC comics universe. And most recently, IDW did Star Trek Year 5, and there was a whole arc with Gary Seven, which you might want to check out because they do that thing where he has a bit of a heel turn and is fighting the crew of the Enterprise for a good chunk of that. So yeah, he's kind of the villain of the piece for a few of those issues. So
That's interesting. I like that. Ooh, cool.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
This episode of Positively Trek is brought to you by our supporters on Patreon. A special thank you to our Constitution Class supporters, Jim Stoffel, Joyce Mirren, and Paul D. Kinnear. To help out with the podcast, visit patreon.com/positivelytrek, where, for a small monthly donation, you can get early access to ad-free episodes, shout-outs, exclusive content, associate producer credits, and more. Thank you so much for listening, and live long and prosper. I'm going to, again, go with TOS, because this is the one that I think is kind of most compelling to me on this list. And that is, if you recall, the season 2 TOS episode, By Any Other Name, the Kelvins from the Andromeda Galaxy. We had this advanced scout team that had taken human form and was scouting out possible invasion plans for the Federation. And by the end of the episode, Kirk convinces them via their new human sensations that they should be peaceful and just settle down, find somewhere to live. They'll get a planet. But the Kelvins are still coming at some point. I think 10,000 years, they said, the Andromeda Galaxy would become uninhabitable, which is why they were wanting to invade the Milky Way galaxy. I don't know what the time frame of that invasion exactly was, but we've now fast forwarded 1,000 years into Discovery. So it would be kind of cool to see some sort of movement on that, like, or at least the Federation saying, like, hey, how close are we to this Kelvin invasion? Oh, okay, let's keep an eye on that or something. Now, I will say, in researching this, I'd forgotten about this, but there's a throwaway line in a Deep Space Nine episode where Worf mentions fighting a Kelvin twice his size. So maybe there's an off-screen invasion attempt already or something, or this is one of the Kelvins from that planet that got settled in TOS or something. But they've been mentioned in a throwaway line at one point in DS9. But other than that, we've not seen them. And if I recall correctly, Spock, when he's kind of touching the mind of one of the Kelvins, sees these immense creatures with like tentacles and like nothing they've ever seen before. So, you know, the potential for some very otherworldly alien species could be really interesting there.
That would be. And the image created kind of actually reminds me of the villain species in the Tom Cruise, Emily Blunt joint, Edge of Tomorrow. where they use time and everything like that to control reality and whatnot and such. But I guess like in real scientific terms, at least as far as we understand with redshift and everything else, Andromeda, actually, they don't need to travel here at all. All they need to do is wait. The Andromeda galaxy is hurtling towards the Milky Way at an unimaginable speed. And I think we joked before we hit record that if they actually got in ships and started traveling, they might be outpaced by the galaxy they were trying to escape getting to the Milky Way, which is an interesting sort of time, gravity, whatever, warping paradox in and of itself. But I never really gave it much thought, the Kelvins especially. And until you brought up its mention in Deep Space Nine, to be honest with you, there's a lot to be talked about. And with the last season of Discovery coming out, there's an opportunity, but I'm not terribly certain what they're going to be covering in that season anyway. So
yeah,
I guess the old adage, we'll see, has to be the big piece there.
For sure. So I did just look it up because I was curious. So the Kelvins do have this amazing ability to tweak warp drives and travel between the galaxies in about 300 years, which is an incredibly fast amount of time.
Yeah.
The Andromeda galaxy is scheduled to smash into the Milky Way in about 4.5 billion years.
Oh, just around the corner. Holy cow.
Yeah, we better...
Set your calendars, folks.
My brain goes to, I love the care. This is a tangent, but I love the genetically engineered misfits that show up on Deep Space Nine a couple times. Mm-hmm. And they have this thing at one point where they're talking about, like, basically the galaxy is going to be destroyed. The forces holding it together are going to come apart. And they're like, how much time do we have? 8 billion years, maybe 9. And the other guy goes, oh no.
Yeah.
I can't remember what the exact numbers were, but it was something along those lines. That's funny.
One of my favorite explanations of how space-time kind of expands and how everything is expanding and how from our perspective it looks like everything else is moving is a friend of mine who's a science teacher has a series of washers that are fixed in place on an elastic band. And as you pull the elastic band apart, just looking normally, you'll see all the washers are moving. But if you focus your attention only on one of the washers as he pulls on it, it looks as though that washer isn't moving and everything else is. So again, just so the implications really do kind of like looking through an inverted kaleidoscope of space and time and everything like that. So to some degree, I wonder if the writers are up to the challenge to even work through something like that. It might be kind of difficult, I would imagine.
Yeah, it requires a lot on the part of the writers, but it also requires a lot to be able to get the watchers to wrap their minds around it.
Like, yeah. Yeah,
that's crazy.
That's a bit much. Well, maybe something a little less high concept. My question is the fish out of water / whale out of water, pun intended, story of Jillian from The Voyage Home, living her life in the future. I wonder what exactly her days would be spent on, how much catching up she'd have to do. And I don't know, I would almost kind of like to be her in that sense, moving to the future and especially if it's a Star Trek future, getting to see all of the things and getting to experience the technology and everything else. I would also be a little fearful of the transporters, though, much like McCoy. I do wonder if it just kills you and reproduces you later. And obviously, Riker is an example of what could happen there. But anyways, I would be interested to see Jillian's story as she settles down in the would be 23rd century, I believe, correct? Or in the 23rd century. Yeah. Right. I always get my 23rd, 24th. You guys got to go back one, and it always hurts my brain.
Yeah, this is one that I've always been fascinated by, too. And actually, she was on my list as well. This was one of our crossovers on our list. Yeah. Jillian Taylor, that story to me is always so compelling. And yeah, you can't help but put yourself in her shoes. And, you know, what would it be like to flash forward to the 23rd century and see all these wondrous things for the first time and live in that universe? There've been, I think, a few times that I can't remember who all was included. I think she was included on this list, but Christopher L. Bennett, once again, did a novel, The Department of Temporal Investigations series, I think it was the first novel, Watching the Clock, and there's like basically a support group for people who've been temporally displaced and like people who've lived through it, you know, help other people through. And I think Gillian Taylor was at least mentioned. It's been a long time since I've read that novel, but it was interesting because they talked about also the humans who were like unfrozen from the the capsule in season one of TNG. And that was a really cool way to explore some of the social issues and stuff, because she basically, this one woman was kind of appalled that her great, great, great granddaughter or something was marrying another woman. It was like, what? That's wild. And then realized, oh, there's people marrying aliens. Like, what am I so hung up on? This is nothing.
Exactly.
So that was kind of a fun thing. And it would be interesting, not just the technological side of that, but also the culture shock. Somebody from 1986 going forward to, you know, 2270, 2280, whatever, what cultural things that we're not even thinking of that they would just take for granted in the 23rd century. Would somebody from the 1980s just be like, wait, what?
To be honest with you, imagine someone from 1986 showing up right now. I'm sure they would also be like, what is going on?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Facebook. What? what's Facebook? Doesn't make any sense to me. The other quick little aside about The Voyage Home, and this one does get brought up. Actually, I remember being in a very long car ride with my friend Matt once. We were driving and talking at length about if a bird of prey just zipping around a sun can travel through time, the Klingons aren't that dumb. They'd know. They'd figure that out. Why aren't they using that more often, right? The Borg tried it. Why couldn't others try it as well? So that's just the little side part. But I am now completely amused by the concept of a temporal traveler person support group. And I honestly have to say it probably came from the Botany Bay incident where people unfroze and wound up in the future and were pretty cheesed off about everything. And so support groups, I would need a support group if I was moving forward in time, I tell you.
Yeah, I think the crew of the Bozeman also made use of that service. Cause and effect ship. Yeah.
I actually have a Bozeman right in front of me here.
Nice.
Yeah, nice little variation on the Reliant. Nice one. And good grab, by the way, there too, in terms of an idea for a support group. I really appreciate that.
Also, with regards to Gillian Taylor, I would be remiss if I didn't do a little plug for a Greg Cox novel that is coming out in July of this year. The original series Lost to Eternity. Actually, really cool. I'm actually going to read the back cover blurb for this one, because I think if you're interested in Gillian Taylor, this one sounds really cool. So, 2024. Almost 40 years ago, marine biologist Gillian Taylor stormed away from her dream job at Sausalito Cetacean Institute and was never seen or heard from again. Now, a new true crime podcast has reopened the cold case, but investigator Melinda Silver has no idea that her search for the truth about Gillian's disappearance will ultimately stretch across time and space and attract the attention of a ruthless obsessive with his own secret agenda.
I need to read this book.
It sounds really good. There's additional bits of the blurb, 2268 and 2292. So it's like a TOS era type thing. But the Gillian Taylor true crime podcast thing is just like, I want to read this now.
That sounds so cool.
Yeah. So July 23rd, that is coming out in paperback, and we will be covering it on the Positively Trek book club. So.
Woot. I love it.
Excited for that one. Greg Cox is a great author, and he does great stuff with like time and our past, combining it with like his Eugenics Wars novels were really interesting. So, all right. I'm going to bring up another one that was on both our lists, and one that comes up a lot. I think a lot of people really want to follow up on this or are curious about it. And that is, of course, the Conspiracy Parasites from TNG season one, from the episode Conspiracy, the ones that very nearly took over all of Starfleet, and they just saved them by the skin of their teeth. And at the end of the episode, there's that mysterious homing signal that's like supposed to call them all in to feast on the Federation, and we never, in canon Star Trek, we never see any kind of outcome of that.
Yeah, the conspiracy bugs again kind of come into that, you know, overly highfalutin, almost impossible to defeat enemy that I do think kind of comes up, and I'm again going to kind of roll this into Control, would be very similar in Discovery as well. These sort of infiltrators, right? Or even to some degree, the shapeshifters in Deep Space Nine as well, you know, and then later, of course, Picard, the final season as well. This infiltration idea that always sort of comes up in Starfleet, that it's this very well put together, highly organized bureaucracy that just immediately gets infiltrated by some of the worst people. And obviously that is a bit of a call to kind of what we're dealing with, I think, right now in certain cases. It's just they're not bugs, folks. They're just people and they're super greedy. But yeah, no, I found that episode for myself to be painfully, painfully just out of this world. Like, you know, I think it's one of the most violent episodes of Star Trek too, long before Discovery, right? You literally see a person's face get melted off and blow up. It's not really, and I hate using this term, but it's not as Star Trek-y as most Star Trek is. It's it really did, again, you know, while TNG was still trying to find its footing, it delved into some very problematic territory, and this was definitely it.
Yeah, it felt very alien, very Terminator, very like trying to kind of get into that part of sci-fi, which feels like a very record scratch moment.
Like, very much what? So. Yeah, not as bad as Code of Honor, but definitely
different reasons.
Yeah, out there as again, a concept that might have worked better, say, in something like an Alien universe, or I could even see Battlestar Galactica doing more with something like that, to be honest. Maybe not Star Wars. Thinking about it, Doctor Who would do well with an enemy like that as well.
And
maybe there is one. I'm sorry, I have not kept up with Doctor Who whatsoever. That is another completely massively vast franchise that would take up a lot of time to get caught up on. So mad props to anyone who does. Lovely series. But I don't have much else to say about these little parasites other than they came and they went, and I'm kind of glad they're gone.
Yeah. That said, I think they make for some interesting implications if done right. I feel like we heard about this thing that was happening a few episodes ago, and now all of a sudden the very top brass of Starfleet are taken over, and boy, that was close. I think that's a little bit ridiculous. I think that got a little out of hand, but I feel like on a smaller scale, these would be a really interesting threat. And it's one that has been revisited a few times outside of the canon works. So the Deep Space Nine relaunch novels, the ones that take place after the series, that really kind of kicked off that shared universe of novels that reigned for a few years until, you know, Paramount picked up the television side of things again. And they said, whoops, well, now actually no. But they did an interesting arc with those parasites. And I won't give away too many spoilers, but they tie them in a really interesting way to the symbionts of Trill as well.
That actually had me thinking, and to some degree it's almost as if the Trill are the non-weaponized versions of those parasites to some degree.
Interesting.
I appreciate that actually quite a bit. Maybe, and this is me just kind of grasping at things a little bit, and it might have been treated a little better in more recent iterations of some deep evil infiltration trying to get us. An episode like that would do better as like the under-arcing storyline to an entire season, right? Throwing it into a 41 minute episode just doesn't really lend itself to the stakes that it's supposed to have or anything along those lines. And so again, I think it's just writers sort of finger painting their way through an episode, trying to make it try to draw in as much of an audience as possible. And you're very right. You know, the early 90s was known for its hyper-violent sci-fi, right? Where you've got Arnold Schwarzenegger peeling out one of his eyes. You've got John Hurt, I think his name was, the character whose chest explodes, an alien. And then you've got the Predator and all these sorts of things. Late 80s, early 90s, sci-fi was known for its blood and guts. And this is definitely a product of that time for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. They do also feature, I will say, and I haven't read these yet, they're kind of the comics that are currently coming out, the Star Trek Defiant comics that are kind of a spinoff of the mainline Star Trek ongoing series right now. According to some of the art of one of the upcoming issues, the cover art. Okay. These guys play a role in that. So I'm not sure what that storyline is. I'm not there yet in the comics, but they're doing something with those parasites. And interestingly enough, tying them to the gangsters of Sigma Iosha 2 in a piece of the action.
And that's where I was going next. McCoy leaves his communicator. Yeah, McCoy leaves his communicator behind. That is a treasure trove, I think, in terms of the idea of an infiltration taking place as well. Imagine a mafia criminal syndicate infiltrating the Federation. And again, maybe getting into touching into realistic politics right now of mafia style criminal syndicates running the show. I think we're kind of in a place like that in certain cases. If you think of the way the financial system works these days and everything else, if we really want something quote unquote ripped from the headlines like Star Trek does, again, that could be a very fascinating arc to make our way through. And we already have everything in place to do that. So Paramount, Dan and I will accept our royalty checks anytime when you want to start putting that series together. And we'd happily be executive producers or consultants for that. We'll just get in touch with us and we'll make that happen.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the communicator left behind on Sigma Iosha 2 has been this hanging thing in the Star Trek universe for a long time.
Over 50 years.
Yep. And it's almost been followed up on at least once in canon Star Trek. The episode of Deep Space Nine that became Trials and Tribulations.
Right.
They were looking at situations to celebrate the 30th anniversary of Star Trek with a special episode. And I don't know how far along it got in the planning, but one of the ideas was they revisit Sigma Iosha 2 and there's like a working starbase in orbit and everyone has become like Star Trek fans basically because of this communicator and the influence that Kirk and company had on the society. Huh. I love Trials and Tribulations. I'm glad we got that episode. I would be very fascinated to see what this episode would have become, though. So,
well, like I said, royalty checks can head our way any point. We're doing your work for free right now. So if they say, the Joker said, if you're good at anything, never do it for free. Which again, yeah. I would say would be kind of the idea of what the gangsters would be up to once they made it to the Federation, especially later iterations of the Federation sort of having money again by the Picard era, right? It doesn't seem like money's a thing, and then it kind of is again. And I don't know. I'm not necessarily against the concept of money. Don't ever get me wrong, folks. It's just when it's used for the powers of evil, just like anything, it can really, really just erode the human spirit in a lot of cases, but it makes for good TV. So Yeah, let's see if we can make that a thing.
So another book that follows up on the gangsters, not necessarily going the direction that Deep Space Nine episode was, but like they still kind of have their gangster society and they're operating in the 24th century and dealing with other worlds. The very, very good Star Trek Picard novel, Rogue Elements by John Jackson Miller. Mm. Check that one out. That came out in 2021, I believe. Very fun novel. And it uses the gangsters of Sigma Iosha 2 in a brilliant way.
Nice. Awesome. What do you got next? We have so many here, folks. Like, seriously, there's so many loose ends. We won't cover them all, but no. I'm realizing you and I have already been talking for over an hour with all of these things. That's remarkable.
Absolutely. Well, I'm going to jump to, I think, the last one on my list because it's one that I really want to talk about. And that is from Star Trek Enterprise, Season 2, Carbon Creek, Mistral, the Vulcan, who ended up staying behind in Carbon Creek in the 1950s. Now, this was one that I thought they were following up on in Season 2 of Picard, with that FBI agent who encounters a Vulcan team and he was mind-melded with. I remember when the trailer came out and you saw signs of Vulcans in the past, I was like, oh my God, they're bringing back Mistral and he's going to... No, that was not part of it.
They did a plié right over that.
Yep, absolutely. You could say
they jumped the shark.
Yeah, they used the concept of what that episode was built around, but didn't use the elements from that episode. I kind of wish they had.
Yeah.
People might scream small universe syndrome, but it's Earth in one country on Earth. Like, yeah, they could have had Mistral there.
Yeah, I guess I should correct myself. They jumped the Vulcan, not the shark.
Yeah, exactly. So I loved that episode. I thought his performance in that episode was really good. J. Paul Bomer was great as this Vulcan. I would have loved to have seen him again show up or have some influence on history or something like that. Would have been really cool. Now, again, this is one that if you go into the novels, most especially, I think the Dayton Ward novel, Forgotten History, uses this character to great effect.
Love me some Dayton Ward.
Oh, yeah. Great, great writer, and uses this stuff that the TV shows kind of leave in their wake. They leave as detritus in their wake, and the novel writers come along and pick up the pieces and build really cool things with them. And that, again, has happened in this situation. But man, would I have actually loved to have seen him on screen again.
Well, it actually, thinking about that, it actually gives the Vulcans more reason to be around Earth if they know that one of their own was chilling out. Because Mestral would technically still be alive probably by the time of first contact anyways, right? Because, you know, I mean, Vulcans live a really long time. He'd be a geezer by that point. But no, it is, again, there's an untapped vein there that would be very interesting to see canon explore a little bit. But again, you know, time is money, so we won't necessarily see him ever again. I would worry in that respect. And I guess maybe just kind of adding my last little bit, most of Enterprise is a loose end for me. Season 4 ending the way it did, how it did, the last episode, there is just so much that kind of floats out in the ether for me in terms of that. But I've heard implications that the guy without the face who Archer's talking to is simply Archer from the future talking to him. I've heard that before. I don't know what exactly to make of that totally. But again, you know, franchises trying to make money over make stories and all that sort of stuff left us with a 4-season Enterprise rather than the hoped for 7. Not necessarily something I'm going to totally complain about. We still get some amazingly good episodes, especially season 3 of Enterprise for me is easily one of my favorite pieces of Star Trek in the franchise's history. Don't get me wrong. But I think, yeah, like, isn't that the season where Observer Effect is in?
Season 4.
That's season 4?
Observer Effect.
Gosh, that's a good...
Which is my favorite season.
Oh, man. What a brilliant episode. So maybe season 4 I like a little bit better. But the Vulcan arc, we really get to see a lot of good stuff out of Enterprise. So I'm not going to say that it's like a loss or anything like that. But just a couple of those loose ends would have been nice to see, figure out. But maybe the mystery is interesting. And I'm going to come back to that a little while later about the mystery actually being better than the answer. But we'll get there.
Okay. Yeah, the future guy thing, I think that was Rick Berman and Brannon Braga, or one of them had said years later that, like, that was one of the ideas they were working with, was that that was actually Archer from the future or something like that. I think the... again, the Department of Temporal Investigations novels by Christopher L. Bennett make him just kind of some bad guy who was trying to control time stuff who he'd never met before, which, respect for that, I guess. Kind of a little bit anticlimactic in my mind.
Okay.
But yeah, he's some dude, which, yeah, I guess that makes the most sense. I always kind of thought he was a Romulan. I don't know why I thought that. I think maybe he had very square, like, shoulder pad looking shoulders, and maybe that's why I thought he was a Romulan, but I don't know. Yeah. That would have been nice to get some answers on that.
His uniform didn't look upholstered, so I can't necessarily say he's a Romulan.
That's true. Absolutely. I guess the last couple on my list, the big one, I guess, is Sisko's return, of course, the end of Deep Space Nine, how that was left. He said he would return maybe tomorrow, maybe a year, maybe yesterday. Of course, we've seen his return in a number of different venues in those novels, the post Deep Space Nine ones, the current run of Star Trek comics that take place after Deep Space Nine. He has also returned in that, but as far as canon Star Trek goes, I would be satisfied. I mean, I can't imagine we're ever going to get Avery Brooks starring in something as Sisko ever again. I would be okay if, even just as an offhand comment, some admiral or somebody on Star Trek, Picard, or whatever series we have that kind of is in that time period makes an offhand comment about the return of Benjamin Sisko last year or something like that. I would be over the moon with that. That would be just, I want some confirmation that he comes back and that Jake's going to be okay and that his new baby is going to have a father and yada, yada, yada.
So this is actually what I was just hinting at is I prefer the mystery. There is, you know, the Abrahamic religions do a very good job of the idea of the Messiah returning or coming, depending on who's where. In terms of Judaism, right, it's the idea that the Messiah is always in the state of coming. He's always going to be arriving. He's in a state of arrival. Whereas in Christianity, of course, the Messiah has already come and will return. And of course, in Islam, it's not the idea that there was one singular Messiah. There's actually been a few, and that the return of Isa, Sayyid Islam, would come back to sort of finish what Muhammad, peace be upon him, said ultimately overall about the law and everything. So I get a very sort of Abrahamic feel to Sisko's departure, right? And the wormhole aliens, of course, the prophets, as they're called, just really touches in to that vein very well. And for a Western mind raised in, you know, kind of a Abrahamically oriented society, I think leaving it where it has does an extremely good job of the mystery. I think Sisko's unity with the prophets ultimately, or wormhole aliens, depending on what side you're on, ultimately sort of completes that sense of Sisko's always returning, right? And there's been more than one Sisko in the past. And, you know, his sacrifice was for us all, you know, so that's kind of covering all three of the Abrahamic religions there to some degree. And yeah, no, Avery Brooks himself, he ain't coming back. he's all done. The beauty of Sisko for me is something big. He's kind of like the Malcolm X of Star Trek in a lot of ways for me, and I really do appreciate that.
Something you said there, and it's very cool if you think of Star Trek as not reality but a series of stories and myths and legends, which it is.
Yep.
Like, let's not kid ourselves.
Ding, 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 ding.
This ain't real. There are so many stories of Sisko's return and how he comes back and what he does when he comes back. If you count these comics that I'm holding up and showing Barry right now, or the novels or whatever. And that is kind of cool. It feeds into that mythos, right? Like, if we imagine, say, in Discovery's time period, somebody is talking about this period of history and they talk about, like, whatever happened with that Sisko thing. Like, I remember they said that he left, he went to the wormhole. What happened after that? And it's like, well, this group says that this happened, but then there's these stories that this happened. And then there's this other group that says that we still await his return. And that actually wasn't Sisko. It was something like, interesting.
It's almost like they're ripping it from the biggest religions in the world, Sikhism and Buddhism notwithstanding.
Fascinating, as someone might say.
Yeah. Speaking of God.
Yes. Okay. So the very last one on my list, I wasn't even sure if we'd get to this one. This is just kind of a mild wondering of mine. We saw Q, of course, in season 2 of Star Trek Picard and the very end of season 3 of Star Trek Picard. Spoilers. But we haven't heard from Q's son, who appeared as an infant in Star Trek Voyager and then as played by Keegan DeLancey in the final season episode of Star Trek Voyager. What's he up to? Is he bringing peace to the Q continuum? Is he bringing the two factions together? What's going on with him? How's he doing? If they want Q in future iterations of Star Trek, why not hire Keegan DeLancey? What's he up to these days? I thought he ably played the character in Voyager. I think he'd be great to see continue that role if we want a Q type figure in future Star Trek. I think he'd be awesome. Now, again, there's a comic series not out yet, but coming, a spinoff of these Star Trek comics coming sometime later this year called Sons of Star Trek, I think March or April. And he apparently figures in that along with Alexander, Jake Sisko, and Nog. So I don't know what he's up to there, but I guess he shows up in the comics, but hey, let's give Keegan Delancey some work. I don't know if he's acting. I don't know what he's doing, but if he's game, I'd love to see Q Jr. again.
Absolutely. I do like the concept of the Q, something of a trickster god, if we want to get into the realm of the higher powers and something like that. Maybe to some degree, a meddler, a shaitan, a Satan, a Lucifer, who wants to corrupt or show mankind, humankind, its corruption and everything. Ultimately, that's Q's whole idea, is he's going to break Picard, and then ultimately Picard kind of breaks him in that respect, and sort of shows him the meaning of mortality, I think, and the idea that, you know, these Q aren't forever, though they can sort of break the bonds of the time space continuum. They are still subject to a certain form of mortality and a certain form of growth as well. So it gives them not really a godlike status, but just like what happens to a person who can just sort of kick the Lego castle over whenever they want. That gets boring. Like, I remember thinking to myself back in the day when I used to play Grand Theft Auto 3, I knew all the cheat codes. Nothing lowers the stakes like knowing all of the cheat codes. And eventually I started playing the game without the cheat codes, just to see if I could do it. And that's an interesting way of looking at things, that sometimes having it all can create a type of poverty. And and I think Q wrestled with that poverty. And ultimately, it's very clear that he doesn't want to teach Picard. He envies Picard. He wants to live through Picard's experience. He wants to see through his eyes. So maybe a Q who might be a little better educated, better understanding, has their poop in a group a little bit more, like Keegan's character was, I would be interested also to see them maybe coming from a different direction. Now, would that just turn them into sort of more of a traveler-like character? I would argue possibly, which kind of has already been something we've tread. But I don't know. I would be interested as well, seeing what we could do with a Q-like character that's been reimagined, maybe is a little more mature. Yeah, that would be very cool.
Yeah.
That would Palling be around awesome. With Trelane.
Yeah, totally. I love your mentioning the cheat codes and playing the, like, that was kind of the theme of the Voyager episode Death Wish, right?
Yes, where exactly.
It was the Q continuum where everybody was bored and they'd been the dog, they'd been the whatever, and they were just bored. And that's why that one Q wanted to end his life, right? So maybe a fresh blood, fresh perspective, which was why Q Jr. was created, is needed in the continuum. I'd love to see that story play out. For sure.
I would call him lowercase.
Lowercase Q. That's interestingly how they refer to him in the novels. I think the Greg Cox Q Continuum trilogy, whenever they're talking about, it's just a lowercase Q.
That's cute. That's cute. Oh, no. Totally. What are we doing? Punny.
We're coming up with future Star Trek Q episode titles.
Again, Paramount, you can send your royalty checks to us anytime you'd like, and we will definitely be happy to take on consulting and executive producer roles on the credits. Thank you.
Well, with that, I guess I'm going to turn it over to our listeners. Is there a favorite one that we've mentioned that you would love to have followed up on? Is there anything we haven't thought of that you would think, like, boy, Star Trek really needs, they've left this question hanging. I really want to know what happened to X, Y, or Z, right? So, let us know. Leave a comment on the post for this episode in the Positively Trek discussion group, or reach out to us, positivelytrek@gmail.com. We would love to hear your thoughts. All that's left is to say thank you so much to my co-host, Barry DeFord, and to wish everybody a great week, and to let you know that we are thinking of you, and to always stay positive. Positively Trek is produced and edited by me, Dan Gunther, and co-produced by Barry DeFord on Treaty 8 territory, the home of the Beaver, Cree, Dene, and Métis people, whose histories, languages, and cultures we respect. We acknowledge the many First Nations, Métis, and Inuit who have lived in and cared for these lands for generations.
As As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.